Good afternoon. This is Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Our topic today is co-housing. What exactly is it? I've got a couple of terrific experts with me in the studio and on the line today so that you can get any question you have about co-housing answered on our program today. Let me just introduce our guests very quickly. In the studio, I have Terry Pauls. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Kathleen.
Now, you are a spokesperson for Raven's Roost, which is a local co-housing effort.
Correct.
We also have Tom Pierce Bulger. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, you're an architect.
I am.
And also a member of this effort for Raven's Roost. So we have two people in the studio talking about local co-housing. And then on the phone, we have Katie McComet. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
And you are calling us from, I believe it's Nevada City, California?
That's right, in the Sierras.
In the Sierras, lovely. So maybe there's a little snow around you?
No.
No snow?
No more.
No more. We still have some. We just got some a day ago, so we still have lots of snow. Anyway, Katie, thank you so much for calling in and joining us for this program. In case folks don't know who Katie is, she kind of wrote the book on co-housing. Why don't you tell us just a little bit about how it dawned in your sort of mind, how you learned about co-housing, how you were drawn to it? I know you traveled to Denmark and learned a lot there, but how did it begin for you, Katie?
Well, it actually began quite a while ago. My husband and I were both young architecture students studying in Copenhagen, and where we came across this these new communities that were just being built. This was back in 1980. And we were quite intrigued with them, and particularly because they seemed to both address a lot of needs about neighborhood, which we felt were really missing in particularly new neighborhoods in most American cities. So we began to sort of explore that and eventually spent another year there studying the Danish co-housing communities, and that became the basis of our book. So we've been involved in design and development of co-housing communities in North America now for the last 2.5 decades.
And I think I read on your website that you live in a co-housing situation currently, right?
Yes, yeah. It's actually the second co-housing community we've personally been owners in. We started in a small urban co-housing community in the middle of the San Francisco Bay Area, and then we moved about 8 years ago to a small town in the Sierra Nevada mountains, where we built a 34-unit co-housing community.
Mm-hmm. I want to throw out our phone number for our listeners who may just be sort of dawning on them that we're going to talk about co-housing, and they may have some questions. We've got some great people who can tackle your questions, so give us a call at 550-8433 in Anchorage. Or if you're outside of Anchorage and, you know, listening to us streaming on your computer, you can call us in at 1-888-353-5752, or feel free to give us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. Our program is going to air again at 7 this evening, and we have lots of information on alaskapublic.org. We've got links to Raven's Roost there. We've got links to articles about co-housing. So it's a real chance to kind of dip your toes in. But to our listeners, I really encourage you to think about this. How does co-housing strike you? We haven't quite gotten to the definition yet, but listen up and then give us your reactions to it. I wonder, you know, one of the things, Katie, I read about in among the Danes is that one of the precipitating experiences they had was kind of a sense of loneliness in single-family homes, even if they weren't a single person living in that single-family home. Does that resonate with what you were hearing way back in the 80s when you were over there?
Yeah, I'm not so sure it's loneliness, because I think most of us are very busy people and we don't have a lot of time to get lonely. But it's the frustration of that everything you need to do, and today it's your play dates that you've got. You know, in order to have someone to your kid to play with, you need to make an appointment and then drive them across town. So it's less about loneliness, just because, we tend to be busy people. We have a lot going on in our lives. But it's the frustration that really more and more we are dependent on the car. even to find our community, to get together with friends, to for our kids to have someone to play with, that we get in the car and drive them there, and wanting to get out of the car and have some of that in proximity, not to replace, you know, the larger neighborhood and city and town of which we're active members of, but that trying to recreate the kinds of neighborhoods that used to exist naturally, which are very, very hard to find today.
You know, let's give folks a good definition of co-housing. I noted earlier before we started that I'd put a note on Facebook about the show, and someone responded, isn't co-housing having roommates? And I don't think that's the definition of co-housing that we're talking about. So let's give folks a definition, if you will.
Yes, a co-housing is a neighborhood of typically of clustered homes, and where you have individual private homes with extensive community facilities, with the intent of really trying to create a strong sense of neighborhood. And one of the other key aspects of a co-housing neighborhood is that the future residents are actually part of the planning and development process. And so in some ways we're creating custom neighborhoods instead of custom homes.
Mm-hmm. And what do you actually own? If you're in, like when you were in San Francisco, what did you own? And now where you are in the Sierra Nevada, what do you own?
Well, I own my own house. And so the community I live in is actually a very good model for what they're trying to create there in Anchorage. You guys, this is a similar size. And so my home is a townhouse, and I own it just like you would any other townhouse. And I have a regular mortgage on it, and you know, all the typical tax deductions and what you have with home ownership in the United States. And then I'm part of a homeowners association. So the legal and financing structure is very similar to other types of townhouse developments. The only thing, but what's really different is that you really know your neighbors. And so when I come home, I walk through my neighborhood and I know every single person on a first name basis, including the kids. And then after I drop my stuff at home, I might go back to our common house where, if I'm lucky, like tonight, one of my neighbors will be making dinner for anybody who signed up for dinner tonight. Or I might check in on the kids playing in the kids' room. Or I might reserve a guest room because I've got friends coming into town next weekend. And it's a more comfortable place for them to stay than to stay with us because we have a small home.
Mm-hmm.
So what's really different is the feeling. But the type of ownership, what we found is that we can adapt the standard condominium townhouse ownership model to co-housing quite well. We don't need to reinvent that.
And I want to invite Terry and Tom to chime in at any time. I am directing questions to Katie because we only have you for a limited amount of time. But is it just typical financing then? And do you find that, for example, banks are warm to the notion of co-housing?
Well, it is an education process, I find. But it is typical financing, and we typically will qualify for all of the Fannie Mae, FHA standards for conventional financing. So, yes, and I think banks, once they understand it, they are quite warm to it, because what you get with a co-housing development is pre-sold units. And so it's really a very solid financial investment because you have owner-occupiers, you know, people have a very strong commitment to long-term health of their neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So I think from a financial perspective, it's actually a very conservative and very strong financial investment.
One of the questions I want to ask you, because you have longevity in this area, you've probably been a consultant to a million, well, not a million, but maybe hundreds of co-housing startups or curious groups that wanted, and I'm sure you have seen some things that you would, you know, recommend against, or you might see some red flags. I mean, what are some of the things you don't like to see happen when one of these fledgling groups starts up? Are there some typical problems they have?
Well, yes, I think actually one of the biggest hurdles is just actually getting a site. And there are many people who dream about a different kind of neighborhood and find co-housing very intriguing. But you've got to get a group that's real and gets realistic and realizes that they're going to have to put their own money down in order to make this happen. So that's where the Raven's Roost group has really, they've taken the leap. They found a great site They've got it under contract. They've purchased portions of it. They've invested their own money, making it real. And I think that's the biggest hurdle. That's what is taking an interest group, or what I call the potluck group, into a real co-housing development group that's ready to actually implement something. And that's where I think the make or break is.
Let me ask
the other thing.
Go ahead.
Yeah, it's just learning how to work together.
Yeah, that was my next question. It's like the social aspects of, you know, being in your neighbor's face all the time. I mean, you know, the consensus model of decision making. How does that work? What can you advise about what works well and what doesn't work well?
Well, I think mostly it's just being deliberate about it. And I think Terry can talk about, they've actually had people come in and work with them on workshops, so that you're building the skills within the group in a deliberate process, and then just paying attention to it. I mean, to me, what's really, you know, as an architect, I work with all different kinds of groups, you know, church groups, city councils. And what's amazing to me is all those groups, they do no training on how to work together. And mm-hmm. kind of bumble along, and you compare that to working with a co-housing group where they're paying attention to that and actually do some training on how to work together, you know, continually trying to improve their skills, and they're a much easier group to work with than the types of groups that are
don't get
doing
any training
all the time.
Well, we'll definitely explore some of Raven Roost's challenges that they figured out how to work through. That'll be fun to do in the second half hour. I want to ask you about what if someone's in the group and maybe they don't keep up their property? I'm imagining the kinds of things people worry about. Okay, they don't mow their lawn. The neighborhood's going down. I mean, how do those kinds of issues get resolved? I mean, some community groups, I remember living in California where there were codes I forget what they were called, but they went through the Planning and Zoning Commission, and you couldn't put your trash out before 5, and you couldn't do this and you couldn't do that. In a co-housing situation, do you tend to have those kind of rules?
Like any condominium, you'll have what they call CC&Rs, which, and that sort of lays out, you know, how the community manages itself and such. And but again, what's different between co-housing and a typical townhouse development is that we're much more reliant on the process. And so the CC&Rs are the real background, that you would only go back to them and look at what was in there, you know, if it wasn't resolved. Otherwise, most commonly is you just talk to people. And so for instance, the garden idea. You know, I'm a gardener, and there's just never enough room for me. And so if my neighbor didn't want to keep theirs up to the standards I thought was necessary, I might actually offer to assist, because that would benefit both of us. Mm-hmm. And in a co-housing community, there would typically be a landscape committee that was working on the community landscape and organizing work days where people can pitch in and mm-hmm. deciding what needs to be hired out, what they're going to do themselves. And so one of the real advantages of working on the neighborhood level as opposed to the individual household level, is I don't have to do it all. I can put my energy and time into the areas that I feel like I can really contribute. And so for me personally, in my community, I'm on the landscape committee and the finance committee, because those are the two areas where I feel like my passions are, and I feel like I can give the most. And then other people take care of other things, and they, you know, so the mechanical engineer is on the building care committee, and he's very helpful when it comes to what do we need to do about the solar system, or, you know, making sure the heating system's all tuned up and being as efficient as possible.
Mm-hmm. And Katie, you know, when a group approaches you, or you approach a group and you're a consultant on co-housing, what are the typical questions that they, you know, do they have trouble wrapping their head around? I mean, you mentioned the banks.
Yes, and that's actually, that's a hurdle for many groups, because in our lifetimes, in the last century, we think about housing as consumers. You know, what products are out there, and how can I get the best square foot, you know, most square foot for the least price? And now you're becoming a developer. You're part of creating the neighborhood. And so understanding the development process is, you know, a real learning process for people. And so that's one of the reasons we work with groups all over the country, is to bring the lessons learned and the best practices from other communities that have been through it. And so you don't have to reinvent the wheel. You do need to find a good group of professionals to work with. You know, you don't want to go off on a multi-million-dollar real estate development having never done anything like that before. So putting together a good team who understands the process, understands the, you know, what's the critical things to holding the budget and such, mm-hmm. Is one of the things that we and other consultants bring to a community like this.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to throw out our phone number one more time for our listeners. Give us a call at 550-8433. And I'm thinking of our listeners. Do you think this kind of community is lacking in Anchorage? Maybe I'm thinking so many of us come from so far away that we actually... You tend to say you make your own Alaska family because the family you grew up with is maybe in California or Idaho or Washington, D.C. So I wonder if that's conducive to co-housing or an obstacle where people are kind of individualistic and, you know, I don't know. I would think bonding people would want to. I think we see that really naturally with potluck suppers that are very common and book clubs that are very common in Anchorage, people having these kind of social events. But I'm wondering, you know, is that something people bring to the co-housing possibility? They think about it that way, or is it something they have to come to secondarily? Because we still think of it as it's a house.
Well, yes. Well, I think, yes, that it is, and I think that that's really what co-housing is responding to, is not only in Alaska, but all across the country, basically in the whole modern developed world, is we no longer live, most of us, very few of us, I should say, live in towns where, you know, the uncle's down the block and grandma's around the corner. Mm-hmm. So we don't have the support network that we traditionally had. And keep in mind that living within the extended family was the way people lived for thousands and thousands of years. This single-family house, your family, you take care of everything on your own, you don't ask for any help, is a very, very new idea. And I think that's the weird one. It's not what we're doing, but the idea that of how we're supposed to live in our own single-family houses today.
Yeah, no, I am. Go ahead.
Well, one of the things I wanted to talk about a little bit is because we raised our daughter in co-housing, and just that, you know, we've kind of been focused on the how-to, but I think the important thing to start with is why. Why would you do this? Why would you go through this trouble? Because certainly, you know, there's plenty of other builders out there building housing, and you wouldn't do it just to get a regular house. You'd do it for something exceptional. And I just wanted to say that I having raised our daughter, and she's now at college and, in fact, about to graduate from college, that it's just the most wonderful way to parent because it doesn't take away from this individual family. You know, our nuclear family, we're traditional mom, dad, and kid. But it really adds to it. And so Jessie had a whole slew of other role models that she could draw and learn from. She had children of all different age around her that were just outside the door, so she had not only peers to play with, but sort of that sense of extended family where you have older kids and younger kids. And to this day, she's an extraordinary communicator with people of all different ages. Hmm. And I think that really is directly related to the fact that she grew up with all different ages and not just casually, but really interacting with people.
That sounds very interesting, the idea that, you know, you could influence what your child's life actually turns out to be and what their skill set might be. Katie, I want to go to a couple of questions that we're starting to get because the goal here is to answer questions. One of the emails is saying, please discuss costs. What is the range of prices for one of these rentals? Now, that's Raven's Roost we would be talking about, right? I mean, and I'm not even sure we have rentals. I think we're talking homeownership here. And we have another caller on the line. We can come back to this when we're ready. But Sandra is calling into Hometown Alaska. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, how are you?
I'm just great. And you've got a question about complying with state law? Go ahead.
Right. I've just heard about the Raven's Roost, and I hadn't had time to investigate. I work with the creation of common interest communities, which it sounds like this would be. And I just wanted to make sure that the developers of the Raven's Roost project know that there is a state law they have to comply with that deals with the creation of common interest communities, by which I mean that if you own anything in common, for instance, the meeting house that the lady was talking about, that you would need to comply with the state law.
And do you know what that law says? I mean,
it's called the Uniform Common Interest Ownership Act.
Yeah. I would just say that, yes, we're used to complying with all sorts of various laws. And, you know, we work within the structure of, and each state is slightly different. But that's, I mean, we have similar, actually, we probably even have much highly more regulated structures in California.
In some other states, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so you're going through, you know, the subdivision process, and you're working within it. And partially that really benefits the community because, again, access sort of to conventional financing that you're not.
Sure.
Trying to reinvent that, too.
I laud the social goals. I just didn't want people to get too far down the road without realizing that they needed to comply with the state act on these common interest communities because, you know, there are very specific requirements for what you need to do.
This is Tom. We do have an excellent attorney that is advising us on all that matters legal, including this common law.
Excellent.
That you're referring to. So I think we've got that
great.
Covered.
I just wanted to check on that. Thank you.
You bet.
Thanks, Sandra. Any other questions? Okay. Goodbye, Sandra. I wanted to deal a little bit on the sort of global level with you, Katie, on costs, because one of the things I learned when I talked with Terry and Tom is this is not lower cost housing. In fact, because you're paying for green space and maybe some common areas, you may be paying a little more than you might guess. So not in an Anchorage sense, I'm talking in a global sense, you know, what's your experience with the price of co-housing in the marketplace in different places you've worked?
Well, exactly. Yeah, good question. We, you know, we'd love to make it, you know, that it was better and cheaper, but it just doesn't work that way, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these are private developments. In most cases, there's no subsidy making them, you know, more affordable. And so you have, it's typically a bit of a premium to buy in because you have the individual private homes plus extensive common facilities. And you tend to have a strong value toward energy efficiency and building green. And that does add a little cost also. So.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. One of the questions I when I looked at Raven's Roost, and they've got a beautiful website with lots of information, and you can get to it from alaskapublic.org, and I'm sure if you just Google Raven's Roost, you will get right there. Lots of information, including member bios, which, of course, I read and was very interested in. And what I thought about is it's a homogenized group economically, and I wondered, around the country and around the world, have there been efforts to make it easier to get into this housing, either through subsidies or partnerships with other housing organizations? I was just wondering, is there a way to diversify the people who can actually get into co-housing? And have you seen that, Katie?
Well, we've worked with all sorts of nonprofit organizations and at the federal level. Hold on one.
Sure. I'm sorry we got you at a bad moment. Take a drink of water.
There we go, yeah. So, but unfortunately, at the same time, we're dealing with this the backlash of a significant housing bust.
Yes.
It's really worked against that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, I could take the whole hour and talk about housing as a right and what we ought to do on national housing policy, but that doesn't help the individual group that's trying to get a project built.
Mm-hmm.
What we found when we first started doing this work and wanted to create our own community and then work with other communities was we basically had to make a choice. We had to say, well, we could spend the rest of our lives trying to influence national housing policy, or we could get some communities built
mm-hmm.
where real people can actually live in them and get out of the theory world and really create, you know, real models that we can actually experience and live in ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we went the practical route.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually work with a national committee trying to influence national housing policy. But right now it's a very difficult context in which we're working in. We're lending. Getting mortgages has been harder. Getting any type of lending has been harder. The federal government's made much tougher restrictions all around, and we're working within that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I think to balance that, what you'll find within a co-housing community is actually much greater income diversification than you would find in most neighborhoods. And there's a lot more there than you would see off the front.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, it's not uncommon for a co-housing owner to rent a room out within their house. And so that's one way that people who aren't in a position to buy is they might do that. Sometimes two people might go together to buy the house. But really, I think the, you know, for better or worse, it's a home ownership model. Not because that's in any way intrinsic to the definition of co-housing, but because that's the way we can actually get real neighborhoods built that real people can live in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what one of the things I often advise communities on is, you know, there's the big world of everything you'd love to do, and then there's actually getting a project built that you can do that in a timeline, you can raise your kids there.
Mm-hmm.
And that means, you know, sort of honing in and really focusing on the, you know, what we can realistically get done.
All right. And I have another question for you, Katie. I'm sorry to be shooting them all at you, but I know we only have you for a half an hour, and Tom and Terry are patient, and we're going to talk about Raven's Roost very soon. I wondered about retrofitting, you know, like a condominium association that goes bust, or you know, can we're talking about building from the ground up, but in urban areas like the San Francisco one where you lived for a while, are you seeing that, you know, downtown areas might refurbish a complex into co-housing?
You certainly could do that. And we've seen there's a number of what we call, well, the way we use retrofit co-housing is actually within existing neighborhoods where people have bought houses next to each other and then taken out the fences and tried to create a stronger sense of community there. And certainly if you, you know, there you could retrofit an existing apartment building. One of the things, though, that I think is really critical for co-housing is that the design supports the intention. And so there are some existing apartment buildings that would work very well, and there are others that you'd just be fighting the architecture because it's really designed to such an extreme for privacy that it's really hard to, you know, casually run into your neighbors. And I think that's one of the things we see in all over the country is we've really designed community right out of our lives so that it doesn't happen because it's not easy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you two more questions because then we have to let you go. But I wanted to ask you, that whole notion of a man's home is his castle, is that something we're fighting against here with co-housing? Is that, you know, that's in the American psyche, or maybe that's in the English law? I don't really know where. But, it, you know, that idea that I've got mine and I've got a fence around it is, you know, is that successfully eroding, do you think, or is it something that has to be conquered?
Oh, I don't think it's either because, you know, co-housing is not for everybody. And really, in the United States, what we need is a lot more housing options. So if someone really, you know, wants their castle and they want to keep the fence and they want to do it their way and they don't want to, you know, work it out with their neighbors, then maybe co-housing is not for them.
Yeah.
But I think there is a lot of people who are looking for something else, who are thinking about a neighborhood where they can count on their neighbors, their kids are safe, they feel safe, they know they can ask for any help, or they get together and have a beer after work, and they, you know, there's just a, that it's easy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, I'm not out to change everybody in the United States, that's for sure.
It'd be a tall order. Yeah.
This is one option, and I think if you're raising kids, if you like, you know, gardening with other people, if you like getting together with friends without having to drive across town, if you like sharing the work and sharing the fun, it's definitely something to look into. And I think the thing, get away, it's not a shared house at all. It's really a neighborhood. But it's a neighborhood in a way that works. It has a lot of the same feeling of the old-fashioned neighborhoods, but it works in our crazy 21st century lifestyle.
And here's my last question for you, Katie. You know, here we're talking theory because we really haven't had one in Anchorage that we could watch. But you have been watching Denmark for 40 years or so. And I just wonder, you know, longevity, how do they hold out? Is it continuing to be very popular in Denmark? You know, by now, they're it's an old system for them. So how's it holding up?
Well, it's holding up very well. And in fact, they hold their value particularly well. The oldest communities here in the lower 48 are over 20 years old now. So we've seen a whole generation of kids grow up and move on.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found, we actually had an appraiser do a study of resale values of some of the earlier co-housing communities in California. And particularly during the housing bust, which we got hit particularly hard with, the co-housing communities held their value much better than most other types of housing around them. And I think that's because it's just a solid neighborhood, mm-hmm. you know, in that sense of people who are really committed to the community itself and to being there long term.
And invested, yeah. Well, Katie McCormick, I want to thank you for taking time out of a very busy day and giving us a half an hour of your experience and your expertise. It was wonderful to have you on Hometown Alaska. So thank you for calling in.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You bet. So we'll take a little break. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. Our topic is co-housing, and I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska on KSKA Anchorage. If you missed part of today's program or would like to listen again to Hometown Alaska, the program repeats tonight at 7 on FM 91.1. Remember, tonight's rebroadcast is recorded and will not be taking phone calls. You can subscribe to free podcasts of Hometown Alaska on our website at alaskapublic.org. This is KSKA Anchorage.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Our topic today is co-housing. We just finished a half an hour with a national expert who really wrote the book on it. We're interested in co-housing because there's a movement here in Anchorage to have a co-housing project. And so the second half hour, we hope to dig into that a little bit. And we really invite callers to, you know, tell us how co-housing strikes you. What about it might you like? What about it might make you nervous? We've got some pretty committed people who are here who have walked that walk and made some decisions, and they might have something to share with you. So give us a call at 550-8433 or an email at hometownatalaskapublic.org. So we have still in the studio with us our local yokels. We have Terry Pauls and Tom Pierce-Bulger. And I told Tom I was going to start with him. He's technically the architect for the group, but also as involved as anybody in Raven's Roost. What brought you to co-housing? Why did it seem like the right thing for you?
I first heard about co-housing. I was in graduate school for architecture. I read Katie's first edition of her book, and it was very intriguing. I come from a very large family, and a neighbor, and this is some years ago, neighborhoods really had that old-fashioned feel to them, and I have experienced at the time recently that the neighborhoods were so, I wouldn't want to say sterile exactly, but they're not, Katie was talking about designing for a neighborhood, and that she used the example of an apartment house, trying to retrofit that, and how they're often designed the exact opposite. And suburbs are very much that way today, and for the last 20, 30 years, privacy has gotten such a big deal that you can literally now drive on the street, not see anybody, or be going too fast to wave, drive into your garage, close the garage door, walk into your house. The front door of your house is no longer the main entry to your house, is the garage.
The Snout House garage. There's been lots of talk about that. Just locally in Anchorage with Title 21, there's been lots of discussion about that. It's been pretty vital.
I don't want to knock privacy too much because privacy, we all need be private. But one of the things that co-housing does, I think, is it has a great combination of privacy. You can be very autonomous within your sphere. In fact, people are more sensitive to that, perhaps. But you still have a neighborhood out there that you can visit. So that.
Where did you grow up, by the way? You talked about having an old-fashioned neighborhood. Where was it?
Kansas City.
Yep. And what kind of house was it? Did it have a big front porch and, you know, that kind of thing?
Yes. It was a decent-sized house. We were on 5 acres. But we had, in those days, the internet wasn't around. So if you wanted to play with somebody, you actually get up off the sofa and ran out and played. And we had, it was in a sort of exurbia, so there were, the houses had a lot of lots, but we had a lot of people that we developed over the years. And again, it takes years to do this. And our communities today, oftentimes our neighborhoods anyway, the turnover is pretty darn high.
Mm-hmm.
In those days, when I was growing up, my whole life, not a single person moved in. They were all, so even though the distance may be a little bit far, you had the sense of a neighborhood.
You
there.
Knew who your neighbors
were.
You
knew everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I often ask people, so do you know who your neighbors are? And you get varying. Sometimes there's one great neighbor that they really know, and they don't know anybody else on the street, you know. Do you think this is kind of a reaction against suburbia then? I mean,
It's a modification of it. It's not every. I mean, the advantages, and the automobile is a wonderful tool, and it's a. If you design too much for the automobile, it's a detriment. So it gives you the freedom, and that's what we've focused on. And so this co-housing, I think, is sort of a reaction to modify that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't want to live in little cubicles, mind you, but they also don't want to live without human contact, without even non-family contact that are close, and you develop a relationship and intimacy with your neighbors.
I want to jump over to Terry and just bring
please.
You in and find out how you came to co-housing.
Yeah, I think it was first when I went to visit a friend who lives just west of Portland, and it was in the 90s, so long ago I don't remember what the name of the place was, but it just struck me as a very comfortable place to be, because with the parking on the periphery, you end up with outdoor spaces that are defined by the placement of the buildings. So you can actually design for kind of a conviviality in the neighborhood, have places set up where there are natural gathering nooks. It's very safe for kids or for elderly people to walk around. So it just had a certain level of comfort that was attractive to me. I'm from a small family, grew up in a neighborhood of about 30 homes that was on a peninsula of a lake, and the kids had the run of the area.
Mm-hmm.
And
sounds pretty nice.
It was pretty ideal.
Yeah.
So this has a similarity in that, again, it's very kid-friendly, very human scale, and kind of organically arranged in a place that supports people instead of the automobile. So the kids aren't stuck on the street playing.
Mm-hmm. Next to cars going down the street. I did read on your website that you just, in January, so a month or so ago, went through the Planning and Zoning Commission and got a green light. What was that process like? Were there challenges? Were there questions? What was it like?
Well, it was fairly cut and dried in one respect. The only objection most people had was traffic, strangely enough. The automobile, again, and people, that's one of the things. You've got cars, pretty soon you have too many of them.
And you need to put them someplace.
And you need to put them someplace. And at rush hour, they're crowding up the streets in front of your house. And many people, nobody likes that.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the main issue. Other than that, it was, most people, I think, really liked the idea. And I think most of the members of the Zoning Commission were quite positive.
Now the traffic issue being, would that be a concern of the people that are around
Correct.
This neighborhood?
Correct.
Because is the density a little higher than it might have been?
No, actually, it's lower than it was zoned for. It was zoned for about 50 homes. So we're doing 35. And if it had been developed by a conventional developer, there would have been two roads to the north that would have impacted a lot of the neighborhoods there. And instead, with our setup, we only have a fire exit out that way that'll mostly have a gate on it all the time. And the entrance is off of Abbott. Just to mention
the location.
The
Let's
location.
Tell people where, and how
well,
big is it?
Not only the location, but that it's within walking distance of the Fred Meyers that's on Abbott and Lake Otis,
mm-hmm.
and so many other stores and restaurants and medical clinics in that area. And then with the paved path that goes pretty nicely to the UMed district up Elmore, And the elementary school that would be used by kids in this area is Trailside, and the trail goes all the way up to Service High School in Trailside. And then Hanshoe is also very close by, and now Pacific Northern Academy is moving in kitty corner to us. And we have a beautiful park just south of Abbott that's largely ignored, Ruth Arcand Park. So that's a lovely asset to our location.
Mm-hmm. Who owns this land? Does Raven's Roost own this land?
Well, no. There are currently three parcels. It's a little complicated, but we have a contract on one parcel. A number of us own the second parcel, and then one of our members owns the third parcel individually. So, then when the construction loan happens and we get to that different stage, then there will actually be
A replat.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Replat meaning the city.
We combine the three lots will be combined into two, and they're reoriented east-west, so that we're also very interested in the solar aspect of mm-hmm. the site. So we reoriented the lots. Originally were going north-south.
And yeah. now they're facing
the south.
For the exposure to sun.
Correct.
Yeah, it's a planned unit development, and we are developing with sustainability in mind. Mm-hmm. So not only do we have, well, for the health reasons, we all want to have as much sunlight as possible during our dark winters, but we're also looking at possibly having solar hot water heating. So mm-hmm. Having that type of exposure to the south, and of course, just to help with the lighting and just our overall good moods to have that southern exposure.
Just if you've just joined us, we're talking co-housing, and now we're talking local. We're talking about Raven's Roost, which is an initiative here in Anchorage that's picking up speed. I have Terry Pauls in the studio with me and Tom Pierce-Bulger, who's an architect and also part of Raven's Roost. I wanted to give people, paint a picture for, you've got a nice drawing on your website of what the lot looks like and the orientation of the homes, and there's some existing buildings that are being incorporated into it. But, you know, what kind of units are we talking about? Are we talking about, if people haven't been there, how would you describe this to them? We'll go to the architect.
The units, for us, the social aspect is actually the most important. So the units themselves are actually very simple. They're moderate in size, and they're oriented towards the south. We're very interested in reducing energy use. So these are very highly insulated. They'll be among the most highly insulated homes in Anchorage. And as Terry said, they're oriented towards the south, so we hope to, at some point, utilize the sun to heat, and it could heat up to half of our hot water needs, not only space heating, but also, more importantly, actually, domestic hot water. They've got tall ceilings. The floor plans are moderate in size, but the vertical section of them is actually pretty good. There are rooms for lofts up above. They're arranged in groups of typically triplexes, although there's one sixplex, and then there's one building that's connected to the common house that actually has 10 units.
And that one has an atrium, doesn't it?
Exactly. I was just, yeah.
And is that designed for older people? Or I just wondered why that special treatment there?
It was, we live in a very snowbound atmosphere. And one of the things that discourages people from communicating during the winter time is the snow and the cold.
So classic. Yeah, that's exactly. Really classic.
It's a good I shouldn't say excuse.
Well, it happens.
It does. It's life. It's human nature. Mm-hmm. So by taking that out of the equation, you now have a 16-foot wide, I think it's an indoor street. It's not really, we've called it an atrium, but it's an indoor street. Sun is coming down from the south, and you can walk down to the common house in your bathrobe if you wanted to. You can sit out front of your door and have a wine and cheese in the evening or coffee in the morning or what mm-hmm. have you, and people walking by. So, and you don't have to shovel your snow.
We've got a caller, so let's go ahead and answer this question. Hi, Susan, how are you?
Hi, I'm pretty good. How are you all doing?
Yeah, great. Thanks for calling Hometown Alaska. What's your question?
I have been looking for this type of community for decades, actually, and was excited to hear about Raven's Roost and did go to a meeting they held. And I was everything sounds great. You know, we want to live sustainably and in community, but it was rather discouraging to learn about the prices of these units. And I don't know, I think the previous lady said there really isn't very much support for people to be able to buy into these. And just wondering, you know, a lot of us who, you know, do have a lot to offer something like this, but don't have as much in the way of resources as people who have invested in this. And I wonder if there's any solutions, ideas about, you know.
Good question. Really good question. I can imagine. When I think about some of the amenities, like, you know, shared childcare or shared yard work, some of the people that could benefit from that a lot might be single moms and dads, you know, that, you know, are really looking for a community, you know. So, that's a good question. We did tackle it a little with Katie, but what can Raven's Roost say about that?
Yeah, when we first started asking builders and other developers, you know, what the cost was here in Anchorage for new construction, we were pretty surprised to learn how high it is. And we were disappointed because we totally acknowledge the caller's point that, unfortunately, even though you get a lot more with co-housing than you do with a standard equal size of square footage, and it's not apples and oranges, so you do get a lot more. Nonetheless, the prices are higher than we had hoped. But again, we're looking at having our 40 walls, our 60 ceilings. We're estimating, like, for a 3-bedroom home, a heating bill that's only $109 a year. So some of those costs that we put in are like capital costs that we will, you know, see a return on, really, in terms of, you know, much, much drastically lower energy bills. But, you know, it's understandable that we're not making a penny off of this. So we're looking for people who can afford it. And, you know, we just wish that we could have lower prices. We feel like we are offering, like Katie said, an option in the housing world for people who might otherwise be buying 3-bedroom homes that are 2,800 square feet, which might be in the same range as our homes. So it's not as though there aren't homes in our price range, which is, give or take 10,000, because there's, you know, this place isn't built. There's still a lot of things up in the air, but our prices are 225 for a 1-bedroom up to a possible range of, you know, 479 for a 4-bedroom. So people do pay that much for homes with that many bedrooms in Anchorage. And then you get, of course, you know, this 4,000 square foot common house as an addition to your home. It's meant to be used
8,000.
As a, you know, a daily place where you're going to actively be there much more often than, say, a clubhouse in a condo with a kids playroom, guest rooms, a large dining area, and a large kitchen and living room, plus probably a rec game room and other facilities, teen area, even a shared walk-in freezer. There's a lot of things there that hopefully people will be using every day. So,
And in your experience, have you seen or heard of any cooperative arrangements? I know Katie said it's a bad time because there was a huge housing bubble collapse, and so the financing and the,
yes,
I guess the versatility of ways of putting things,
yeah,
together isn't really there right now. But have you, either of you, Tom or Terry, heard of anything?
I've lived in two different co-housing places for 1 month each, in addition to visiting a whole bunch of others. And I did notice that what happens is once the co-housing development is built and people own the homes, some people, life happens, and they end up possibly temporarily leaving for several years or something like that, and they end up renting out their units. Now, we can't have a whole lot of rentals, or it's hard for new purchasers to get mortgages, but there do usually end up being some units being rented by the individual homeowner.
There's also, by the way, some financing available with 5% down. Local financing at competitive rates. So that can help too once it's built. So at the moment, I don't think there's much in the way of subsidies available. VA financing is another one, by the way. They can up to 100%, no down payment at all. So there are other options.
Yeah, and like Katie mentioned, sometimes two people might actually be able to go in and buy something together or have housemates. I've had that before in my life in the house that I live. And I just wanted to mention, coming back to Katie's point, you know, why? Why do all this? And so I currently live in a three-bedroom home that's bigger than I need. And the reason I bought that home was that I wanted to have housemates. I'm single. And I did have a lot of fun with housemates for a while, and then it just got to be too much. You get to a certain age and you get tired of sharing your kitchen and living room and everything. Mm-hmm. And what I really love about co-housing is the privacy gradient. I can have my own space, my own privacy at a reasonable size, but yet if I just stumble out my own front door, I have all the neighborhood friendliness that I could want. And I can choose. And right now in my own private home, my only choice is between privacy and more privacy. Mm-hmm. And I find that a lot of people say, Terry, how are you going to leave that big, beautiful house? It's so lovely. And what I've learned over time is that my happiness is not defined by the size of my house, the comfort, or the view. It's defined really more by how many times a day I laugh. Mm-hmm. And so it's much more about the relationships, which is a lot easier to have a lot more fun in co-housing, where you have the richness of all these other people with all their different skills, people making beer, sharing, you know, canning tomatoes, sharing the gardening. We plan to have extensive gardens, being able to take part in the lives of kids, you know, of other families and things like that.
One of the things that we touched on, I know, was the social aspects. And I mean, I went reading and, you know, lots of people are touring. They're trying to get informed. These are stories in the national media that I just was reading. And, you know, one of them was the challenges that people who are living in co-housing feel. I'm just going to read this one short paragraph. Ms. West and Mr. Planchon were clear that co-housing presented challenges, too. Ms. West recounted a heated episode at her community where someone didn't receive a party invitation. They also spoke of meeting fatigue, a byproduct of reaching decisions via consensus model, and the surprisingly volatile matter of pets. So I thought, you probably have read these same stories, you know. I know there's lots of stuff to read online, and pets came up a lot. So, you know, is there a leader or, you know, who do you elect a co-chairman? I mean, how do you get through the processes, the social processes? Because when you throw people together, they're going to have conflict.
Yeah, we have a group called the Process Team, and we have the benefit of learning from these other co-housing communities. And we kind of take that approach. Before we really, you know, jump into a certain policy or discussion, we look around at what other groups have learned and what makes it most smooth for them. And we have chosen to invest in learning group process skills. Like Katie mentioned, we've had a couple workshops now, one about our values and visioning, to be sure we're on the same page, and then one about conflict resolution, consensus decision making, and just, you know, how to approach those types of issues you're talking about. And for a lot of us, it's quite intriguing to learn how to get along, because that is really, if you look at the really big global picture, the challenge of humanity is how to learn to get along. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's actually, you know, fun to look at different processes to figure out how smooth we can make it.
Tell me a little bit about maybe some of the areas you had some friction in. I mean, I know that there's actually two co-housing groups in Anchorage that were once together but didn't care for the geographic locations. I don't know whether that was an issue or was it an easy decision? But I mean, what are some of the conflict points you've had to work on?
Yeah, that wasn't so much friction. It was simply a question to the whole group, which originally was about 30 households, as to whether or not they wanted to live on this land on Abbott Road. And it's simple and understandable that some of them prefer to live in Midtown, downtown, where they currently live. And so for them, they're still looking for land in that area, which is higher priced area. So that wasn't, I was part of that group, and I don't think that was really a conflict
at all. Not a friction, just a decision.
There are as many pet policies as there are co-housing places. But the key is, if you get the process down, if you get the process of solving the conflicts down, then you can pretty much, I think you can pretty much grapple, you know, in a healthful manner and in a successful manner with almost any challenge that comes your way. I mean, so there's the classic to cut down the tree or not to cut down the tree that's out on the green that's died or something like that. And if you have worked out, you know, how your community deals with any question or any issue, the consensus model, the real key to it is that everybody has a chance to be heard, and we actively seek everyone's voice. And so that actually reduces a lot of conflict right there, because no one feels like, you know, they haven't been listened to.
Mm-hmm. But it's a long, slow process.
Well, interestingly, when I've been at these other places, I'll ask people, what's your favorite part about co-housing and what's your least favorite part? And sometimes when I ask that, what the least favorite part is, they'll say consensus decision making, because if they don't do it real effectively, the meetings can become long. But then I'll ask what their favorite part is. And a couple of them have said, you know, laughing while they say it, they'll say the consensus decision making process, because, you know, it's different than what we're doing every single day in our society. And for a lot of people, this whole co-housing project is the biggest personal growth experience they'll ever have. And a lot of people who live in co-housing will say that they've become better people because of it.
Mm-hmm.
They've learned how to listen, how to compromise, how to get along,
yeah,
and enjoy the process.
We have about 5 minutes left, just to keep us all on the same page. How much are you in financially at this point? Can you speak to that a little bit? I mean, and does the loan come to Raven's Roost, the construction loan, does it go to Raven's Roost? I mean, how does that all work? I'm not a high finance person. And we only have actually about 3 minutes. Yeah.
That's not really that high finance. The construction loan is done, since we are acting as the developers. The construction loan is with the group, LLC. We have a Raven's Roost LLC. What was your other question, Leanne?
How much are you in financially? Oh. You know, I just, you know, we know what prices are.
Yeah, we as a group, as the members join, we have what's called full equity membership, and we each put in $3,000 a month towards our common costs, or the development costs, excuse me. And if necessary, we can raise more. I mean, it's sort of, in a sense, we're all in. We're all in.
Yeah.
Each person has their own. Each family has their own financial limits. But if you make the commitment to this concept, then we'll figure out a way to make it happen.
Yeah, you know, I've been on a couple juries here where there were condo associations and they didn't have the money to put the roof on.
Mm-hmm.
And so
mm-hmm.
I thought, okay, for collective ownership, you must have a pot of money
sure.
for stuff like that. And this is part of that sort of thing.
Well, that actually comes later after it's built. But yes, there's definitely contingency funding.
Yeah. Is there like monthly dues for mm-hmm. the, you know, snow mm-hmm. removal and the, yeah, and whatever? Yeah.
Well, actually, the snow removal we'll do ourselves. But that's one of the differences we'll have with condo associations, is we'll actually do a lot of the work. We have more of a, I shouldn't say more of a commitment, but you have a commitment with your neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're willing to do those kinds of things if you have the skill levels.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, our fees will be lower than a typical condo, because we have to save for the roof replacement 30 years from now, et cetera, just like everybody else does.
Mm-hmm.
Painting,
mm-hmm.
the general buildings, that's the same. But the ongoing cost, and plus our high efficiency common house takes very little money to operate.
Mm-hmm.
So our costs are going to be lower.
Kind of expensive going in, but yeah. Because of your efforts at energy savings
right.
and things like that. So what haven't we talked about that we've just got about a minute?
We have an open house coming up on Wednesday, April 17th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at Middleway Cafe. So be sure to come there. We also have a monthly potluck. So check the website, ravensroostcoho.org.
All right. And we want to let folks know, thank you, Tom and Terry and Katie. Next week on Hometown Alaska, host Charles Wolforth will discuss the results of the municipal election on Tuesday. Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can join us on Facebook at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is Vice President of Public Media. Kristen Spack is our web editor and audio engineer. Thanks so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and do not reflect KSKA or its underwriters. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies can be purchased by calling 550-8400. This is KSKA Anchorage.